right, advertiser time. So, first off, our OG sponsor, Sinister Jerky. Use code KINGDOM, that's KINGDOM, at checkout at www.sinisterjerky.com. Grab yourself a nice little discount. And also, this podcast is powered by Balls Garara. Grab life by the balls. And with that said, let's go on to the podcast.
All right, welcome back to Castle Comms, episode 107. Today, we got a treat. Not only is my voice completely thrashed, but we probably have the most educated person who's ever been in the Castle Comms keep. We have the one, the only, Dang Newbie. Dang Newbie, how you doing today?
Hey, man, doing good. It's a rainy Sunday here, so just vibing and hanging out in the basement.
That's the best way to be, man. Like, anywhere where you're safe from the horrors of Christmas music, it's a safe place to be. Now, I saw that you recently lost your fight against the treacherous Mariah Carey song. Like, how did that go down?
Oh, God, yeah. So, honest to God, I went to the doctor for, I had an ear, pain in my ear and was like, I gotta go see the doc. So, got an emergency afternoon appointment, like 4 o'clock, right before they close. And I get there and I walk in and it's the middle of All I Want for Christmas Is You, like right in the lobby.
No.
And I'm like, oh, man, just like, I already feel bad. I don't want to feel worse.
The doctor was hoping he could just drag his patients out with that. And he was just like, I want to go home early today. Maybe I can make some people.
No, it was like they were playing the CD, man. That it was even worse. Like when I came out, they had like another song from her Christmas album or something going on. I was just like,
Jesus.
It's like the poor receptionist was like for an hour was under like Mariah Carey assault. So I was like, oh,
was
my God.
Was she bleeding from the ears?
I left, man. I'm not gonna lie. I didn't look back.
I don't blame you at all. See, my most hated one is Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time because that song is just terrible.
Oh, God,
it feels so phoned in. Like, they're at one point like, we're here tonight, and that's enough. It's like, why don't you just say fuck it at that point? Like, fuck it.
Well, I think there was a meme going around a couple of years ago about if you think about the lyrics, it's really a satanic ritual. They're like doing a summoning and then they get caught and then they're like simply having a wonderful Christmas
time. I'm here for it.
Rather than like the time is right, the moon is up, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, oh, somebody came along and they were like, we're simply having a wonderful Christmas time, not summoning anything over
right?
here.
It's
but yeah, that one should almost revoke Sir Paul's membership in the Beatles, just like that one song
it's
alone.
Like they had to take down all the Ringo songs. Like, this is now the worst thing we have ever done, Paul.
It's like, yeah, George can be having like his Maharaji and doing all this stuff with his guitar and like India 1968 and all that and Sgt. Pepper's, you know, all the psychedelic stuff. But yeah, instead we have this Christmas crap that we have to throw out there as our worst
like
song
begging,
ever.
Please get back on the drugs, Paul. Please. This is terrible. We can't do this again.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty
oh,
much
man. It. It's yeah. This time of year is always so weird because like not only as an adult, is it weird? Because, like, you know, if you do the whole family song and dance, you have to put on the facade and you got to, like, be happy all moments of the day. But when you have a child, like, I have two little babies. Like, one's 3 months, so she's, like, oblivious. And the other one is, like, 3 years old, so she's, like, super getting into it. Like, you know, like, first real cognizant Christmas. And it's, like, one of those things where it's, like, oh, no, I never wanted to promote, like, all these Santa Claus things, but here I am doing, like, Elf on a Shelf and all this other stuff I said I was never going to do. So my question is, what was one weird thing from your childhood around this time of year that was placed upon you or, like, a family tradition or something weird like that, and did you carry that on?
Well, I don't have kids, so I didn't carry anything on. So it's I have dogs. That's
but you
that's
could still
my,
like you know
my
do
furry,
it though.
Furry right. children. But yeah, the Olin Mills Santa Claus pictures I would have to go with, and I did carry it on. My dogs always sit with Santa this time of year and get a picture taken, and that usually is my Christmas card. From us is basically Something with, we do Welsh Terriers, so we pretty much have a little, you know, 20-pound terrorist on Santa's lap. beards are not safe at all. And so it's basically, you know, it's like, I guess, having a three-year-old who basically won't sit still, won't do anything. So that age, like, permanent.
I would make the argument that they're probably more well-behaved than a three-year-old.
I don't know. They're terriers, man.
But they don't have the opposable thumbs, dang. They don't have the opposable thumbs.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, I look at it like, you know, they don't stop. That commercial with the dog jumping through the sunroof, the terrier, and the lady's like, the vet says when she's seven, she'll calm down. And I'm like, no, the vet's lying to you. At least the three-year-old takes naps. That's all I can say.
That is true. They do take naps. But you know what? I've never seen a terrier take a shit on the ground and then pick up that shit and smear it on the wall. I've never seen a terrier do that.
This is true. This is true. She doesn't do that.
Yeah.
She might track it. She might step in it and run through the rug, but no.
That's not a purposeful artistic moment.
No, we aren't exploring modern art.
Exactly. So speaking of modern art and things like that, dang, I have to know. So when you went to Oxford, what was your field of study?
I studied, I went there for a semester at the end of my bachelor's degree at George Mason University. And I was invited to go for the semester, and I had to choose my own tutorials, which basically was take something from my bachelor degree catalog at the university, at my home university at Mason, and then propose it for a study in the tutorial format that they do at Oxford. So I had actual Oxford dons for my two instructors, both of them, like one lady who was my Arthurian legend Don, she actually wrote her doctorate on the origins of the word "the" in the English language.
When you said Oxford,
she's literally
Don,
like Middle English.
I just picture like the Godfather Don wearing like a tweed jacket with like patches on the elbows. Like, you come to me asking for electives.
Nah, it's like if you ever watch UK television, anything out of the BBC where they got the tweed jacket and the pipe and the bushy eyebrows and you know, they talk like an imperial from the Empire. They all have the posh accent, by the way, so they all sound like, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Peter Cushing and Grand Moff Tarkin,
right,
you know.
Right.
So, but they've all written the books. Like, you go in and you're like, you can't bullshit. There's zero bullshit because they wrote the book, literally.
That's horrible.
Like, you get a question. Yeah, you get a question that you have to answer. Well, they give you like five questions.
Okay.
And this is every week for 8 weeks. You come to class. You spend an hour basically with them going over your paper that you wrote that week. And it's like a 2,500 to 5,000 word paper for the week. And they're like, they literally like try and attack every position that you hold in the paper. And they've, like I said, they've written a lot of the books that you have to use for source material. So they know the material. And so it's like a relentless assault for an hour. Just bam, bam, bam. What about this? What do you think Vinever meant by this? What do you think, you know, Mallory meant by writing the Arthurian, you know, story this way? What do you think? Did he do this?
Sounds like the intellectual's like, version of blood in, blood out, like gangs do. Like, you're just getting beaten.
Yeah, it's like literally like sit down, defend your life for an hour. And if you emerge, you get a mark. And it's like so many marks are, you know, the best marks or whatever. And then they give you a list of like five or six questions. They want you to pick one of the questions to answer.
Right.
And the two tutorials I took when I was there, one was just writing general poetry. So I went there with a mind of just let me learn how to write poetry with somebody who's a master at poetry in Oxford. And the other one I went in was actually the one that I just picked as a fun topic, which was I wanted to study the evolution of the Arthurian myth, like from the very origins of Mort d'Arthur all the way through to, like, you know, Monty Python's Holy Grail.
Right.
And so for 8 weeks, you get some questions and you basically go through and answer them in that case, in the Arthurian, it was essay. In the poetry one, it was like, write me 6 sonnets by next week.
So when it came to, like, poetry and coming in, like, what was your, like, moment where you're like, I'm into this? Like, were you, like, a little kid and you saw, like, a writing on a bathroom wall and you're like, that limerick hooked me for life? Or, like, what was the moment where the light switch flicked?
So I was, like, I grew up in a really tiny town, like 2,000 people. And went to Michigan State University when I was 18, graduated high school, like, got into MSU, went there, and there's like 45,000 kids that live on campus at Michigan State. So I immediately went from, like, you know, fish out of water status day one got there.
Like, so crazy culture shock. In my teens. Like, all these fucking people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, like, I wasn't prepared at all. My little town did not prepare me at all for academics at a major university. So, not surprisingly, I flunked out. I went back in my 40s. I went back to school. And I was trying to choose a major at Mason that was not going to require me to take a ton of math because I hate doing math.
I feel that.
I can do it. I just hate doing it. Everyone wants you to show the work. And I'm like, no, I did it in my head. I don't want to write it down. So anyway, I was looking at, like, communications and English and a couple others. And it jumped out to me that if I took English, I only had to take liberal arts math.
Right.
So I was like, I'm it. I'm down for that. I'll take liberal arts math. So I went into there and they have, like, they have 5 different concentrations, and the only two that really appealed to me was technical writing and creative writing. Well, technical writing is what I do for my day job. I'm a project manager. Okay. So I write that all the time. So I was like, I don't go home and dig ditches after, you know, working digging ditches all day. Why would I go home and write technical stuff for college? Right. So I was like, let me take creative writing. Maybe I'll understand or do that better. And I went into the first class, and they had you write 2 poems, a short story, and a couple of other exercises in creative writing. And by the end of that semester, they had us submit some of our stuff for publication, and my poem got picked up.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was like, okay. And the woman that was teaching the class was a GA student from the master's program. And we had these one-on-one conferences at the end of the, because this was like an intro 300 level class, like intro to creative writing. And she pulls me aside in the conference and is like, the stuff you're writing for poetry is better than I do. And I'm getting a master's in it. And so I was like,
okay. How validating was that? Like, from somebody that, like, their first go at it wasn't as successful as it could have been, to being told, be like, oh my God, you're very good at this.
Like, well, it's like I wrote emails, you know, I convinced managers to give me money to run projects or give me resources to finish projects and stuff like that. So I knew how to do, like, I knew how to write in a way to coerce people to my point of view, but I'd never applied that to, like, creatively. Never knew that I could do that as a storyteller more, you know, take that storytelling element. And so for her to sit down and go, you know, I'm working on a novel, and the stuff you're writing in this short story is better than what I have in my novel. And I'm like, it's really validating to have someone, even, you know, a graduate student tell you that. So for me, it was like, I'm on the right path. I'm going to finish this path. And the goal was to get a bachelor's degree, because I had lost my job. And it was like, get a degree, because I kept coming in second in all the interviews. And the, what one of the recruiters told me was, you don't have a degree, so finish your degree and you'll get more yeses from these employers. So the, I went from that to all of a sudden there's, you know, this open path of writing poetry and short stories and novels and stuff like that.
Now, when you said you got published, was it like in a big like tome of work? Was it like in a magazine? Was it in a, like what form was it in?
The first one that I got published was on an online, it's an online academic journal. It's run by a guy who used to run the Cleveland Gazette paper, and now he does this in his retirement. He has like a site where he takes poetry and short form stories and photography and puts them all together online to make like an online forum. But the other places I've been published, some of them are actual published academic journals or poetry journals. So mostly in that format. I haven't published like or self-published anything on like Amazon or stuff like that, but I'm looking into that.
Nice. So when it comes to all of that stuff, like how do you deal with writer's block? How do you deal with like mental blocks? Because I'm sure that comes up quite frequently in that line of work, especially when you have to make things rhyme and flow certain ways, or you're doing things that have to fit certain formats like a haiku. Like I'm sure that can be very frustrating at times. Like how do you deal with that?
I don't have a writing style where you know, writer's block usually comes in. I generally just don't write if I'm in that block. It's weird. I have this, you know, I sit down and have an idea like pop into my head and I'll blink and look and I've written, you know, 10 pages of a story.
Nice.
And it's like, it just came out. It like flows. It's almost like channeling, you know, like somebody channeling a medium or whatever, channeling a spirit. But it's like all of a sudden it's just there. And I can't explain it because it's like, I am terrible. If you give me like, you must write about Alzheimer's. And it's like, I don't know if, you know, I've experienced Alzheimer's. I've had, you know, a mother-in-law that had it. So, but for me to just write creatively about it, I can't. Right. I don't really work that way. And so for me, writer's block is more, I just don't sit down and do the writing. And it's that's worse and kind of what's affected me the last year or so is I just with work and all of the stuff with the health issues and stuff I had this year, it's like I didn't set aside time every week just to sit down and do that flow. And that's where I get more writer's block on. You know, just too lazy to do it or don't dedicate the time or just nothing is coming through that channel that I see and write it down.
So is gaming is one of those things that you engage in when you're kind of in one of those downward slopes of like, oh, like nothing's coming to mind. I'm going to play RimWorld or I'm going to do some crazy shit on Tarkov or, you know, insert game here. Is that kind of like your filling?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, gaming has always been one of my releases. I don't punch walls. I don't do anything else like that. When I get stressed, I shoot pixels.
I mean, that's the most healthy way to deal with it. You know, like it's a lot better than that.
10 minutes in GTA with like as many stars as I want to get. I don't care. You know, just, you know, I'm going to blow up the whole world. There was one that was like, what was it? There's a game like in the late 90s, early 2000s where you were a god and you could rename the little
black and white
villagers. Black and white. That's what it
Great
was.
Great game. And then your little avatar Somebody would tick is me like, off. Either like a dancing cow or like some ridiculous animal.
Yeah. But someone would tick me off at work and I just rename all the villagers that person and punt them into the ocean. And that was like my release. That was all I ever played in that game was just like, you know, Bill's a real jerk today, so I'm just going to punt him into the ocean about 50 times.
You thought you were going to be a breeder, Bill? No, you're going to be a fish food.
No, Bill. No, Bill, you're going to get eaten by a shark. Here you go. Bam.
I'll see you in hell, Bill.
But yeah, that, I've always used it like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So when it came to streaming, like, were you, like, watching Twitch beforehand? Like, what got you into the platform? Was it just a happenstance, or how did that come to be?
So I lived in a Gregorian mansion that was built in 1756. When I was in Oxford, and they had no TV. We had a four megabyte download ISBN line for nine of us to share on Wi-Fi. And the only thing I had for real entertainment, because no TV, no nothing else, you know, no real radio or anything like that, was whatever I could do through my laptop when I was there. And I just started watching streaming. Like Sequisha was one of the first ones I watched, and Filthy Robot for things, for strategy games and stuff like that. And I would just sit, you know, while my brain was melting from reading, you know, an entire book or something that evening, was just like, it was mind numbing that I could just listen to somebody talk about games.
Right. Right. And then the games that you like to partake in are also, I've kind of noticed, they're the unforgiving strategy type, like a Battle Brothers, like a RimWorld, like a Tarkov,
oh, yeah,
where your thoughts, like, you know, there's a lot of thought that goes into it. You really can't go into most of those situations blind, especially Battle Brothers or a RimWorld. Tarkov, you know, you can just reset. It's okay. They're just pixels. But in those ones, there's permadeath. Like, once you lose your team, you're pretty much done, and you got to start from ground zero. So has that style of gaming, it's funny because you're saying that this is kind of like your palate cleanser, your relaxing thing. Do you think it's kind of funny that your relaxing games are like stressful in nature?
No, because it's exactly that thing is like, I get to do some storytelling in RimWorld, and I get to, like, if I make my own scenario up or something, and it's like, I'll make my own goals, and it's like, we have to do this, but like the one we just finished a couple of weeks ago was Drunken Santa. And so we have a pawn that represents Santa, and he's a drunk. He has to drink beer every day or he dies. And we have four elves that are like Secret Service Terminator type elves that, like, you would see from the Santa Claus, the ones that, you know, bust him out of prison,
yeah,
and all
the
that.
Tim Allen, like, Santa Claus.
This is like, yeah, SEAL Team 6 elves. And it's like, okay, so yeah, we've got four elves that can kick ass and do whatever, and Drunk Santa, who barely, you know, gets out of his sleigh without falling over. And we just do things like that, and it's really, like, for me, it's, if we make it, we make it, if we don't, we don't. And because I involve my chat in a lot of the gameplay, it's like, oh, I didn't die, you know, that chat member died.
Oh,
I feel bad, you know. I feel bad that my decision made that chat member get shot in the face with a shotgun, but, you know, I'll get over
it. This is part of the plot, you know? Like, great stories, yeah, have just casualties. Well,
we're gonna make it off this planet, but poor Timmy didn't make it.
right. So, being from somebody with this kind of background of creative writing, poetry, things like that, mm-hmm. Now, do you find yourself to be hypercritical of stories, or do you find yourself to delve even deeper when it comes to certain stories? Like, if you get something that's super deep lore, like a Star Wars, like a Warhammer 40K, things like that.
If it's something that I enjoy, a genre I enjoy, like sci-fi or speculative fiction, like a Harry Potter or something like that, I am more often willing to forgive. If you sit me down in front of like a Hallmark movie, I'm going to go nuts. I'm just literally going to, I'll literally grind my teeth not to say something, especially if I know someone likes the genre. But you give me something like that's super hypercritical, terrible writing, terrible cliches, you know, it's always the rugged, good looking, outdoorsy billionaire, secret billionaire on like the, it's like yet another movie with Hallmark movie with a blonde lady as the, you know, protagonist. And it's
the
just like
a billionaire with a six pack.
Yeah. Yeah, with like a beard and an axe on his shoulder, and he's cutting down the Christmas tree, and yeah, it's just like, stuff like that drives me.
See, that's
batty.
What Hallmark needs. They need to update. They need to have the OnlyFans model with a heart of gold who gives to charity. That's what they need.
Yeah, we or even just go for a brunette or a redhead once in a while. You know, not the usual.
Just a little and diversity. It's just,
there's writing like that. Yeah, there's writing like that that I get annoyed at, and I have a hard time sitting
right,
through.
I bet.
I really have been looking at like a lot of foreign stuff, BBC, there's some French mystery series that my wife has gotten into, and it's like the writing is just different because it's not Americanized.
Right, it's a completely different lens. Like when
yeah,
you read a
and
Russian
it's like
author.
You look at the flawed. Yeah. All of their detectives are flawed. They all have something wrong, you know. One's an alcoholic, one hates everybody, you know, that sort of thing. And it's more about, you know, character development and actually solving the mystery than it is about, you know, guns and explosions and car chases and, you know,
things like that.
Yeah, that kind
right,
of thing.
Totally. So, do you have a favorite author?
I do. Tolkien is definitely top of my list. And that was really awesome being in Oxford and literally like seeing his house, seeing his grave, going to his pub and reading the Silmarillion in his pub.
That's crazy. Was that kind of like an awe, like, oh my God, I'm where this guy used to hang out kind of thing? Was it kind of like...
Yeah, I went to Exeter College for a couple of my tutorials, and he taught there, so you can actually go to his office and they give tours and stuff. And so my Don actually got me into his office just to stand there and go, you know, you're in Tolkien's office. He literally taught here.
That's crazy.
And you're just like, oh my God. And like you can go into the Eagle and Child pub, and he and the other members of the Inkling Club met there. So not only were you there where Tolkien had written, but, you know, C.S. Eliot had written there too.
Big names.
Or C.S. Lewis. And so it's like you got all these people who wrote, you know, Narnia, wrote Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, right. You know, they're all here in this one spot. And you're just like, and I'm here. I'm the dumbest guy in Oxford right now writing. But Tolkien was here, and he was the dumbest guy at one point. And, you know, Lewis was here, and Lewis Carroll was here, and he was the dumbest guy at one point. And C.S. Lewis was here, and he was the dumbest guy at one point. And you're just like, yeah, that was the biggest thing about that. That was, you know, living where your heroes had once been. And then just like, how the hell did I get here?
Walking amongst giants kind of thing. That's crazy.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, that's a really good thing to bring up too, like saying that they at one point were the dumbest person there, because like I see that a lot, the mentality in the streamer world where somebody's like, you know, getting started and like, I'll never be there. And like, well, that person you idolize was there at one point, you know, the person you idolize was like brand new day one person themselves at one point. So, I mean, that end goal is not impossible.
Yeah, Ninja and Pestily and Sequisha and other guys like that, they've all talked to empty rooms.
Right.
And that's the biggest thing about it is like, you got to start there. And how you get, you know, up in the in that streaming world is up to you. I'm in a unique position. I have a day job. And I made the decision when I started this that this would be a hobby for me. So I'm not competing with other streamers. I'm here to share the journey. I'm here to play games with other people. I'm here to, you know, fill a void that school left in a way, because I quit gaming while I was in school. Right. So I lost my gaming clan. I lost all my, you know, friends that I had played with. They totally, you know, dissolved in the years that I was gone with school. And so it was like, to me, this is filling a different void. I'm not trying to be the thousand, you know, concurrent viewer a night person. It'd be nice. I'd love to have that many friends playing games with me, but you know, if I get 10 people in the chat, I'm excited.
Right, totally. It's not one of those things where you're not going on there to be the most crack guy. You're not trying to hit 360 no scopes so you can join FaZe Clan and do keg stands. You're there to have a good time.
Oh, with my physical disabilities anyway, I'm never going to be that guy. I mean, I struggle in most nights to be the average Tarkov player.
I think we all struggle to be the average Tarkov player. Let's be real.
I've always explained to people that my playstyle on Tarkov is, you know, a Jawa. I literally will pick up a $2 item, a 2-ruble item, you know, because I tend to have to play that slow and methodical and listen and try to, you know, ambush somebody coming around the corner. Because if I W a kid, I'm going to die.
Picturing you're 100% of the bush. Time.
Yeah, I mean, that's me. Literally, like, I went through the dumpster and I found this, and how many rubles is this worth? You know, that's my playstyle on Tarkov. I play my scav, you know, every time it's available.
Oh, yeah.
Because, hey, free money.
And it's free practice, too. It's also, like, when I get scavs, I'm either looking for money, food, whatever, or I'm also like, hey, let's practice PvP with a gun I never try. And sometimes you find little diamonds in the rough. Like, I never run this gun, and I like it now.
Oh, yeah, that's like, yeah, it's, and that, and I'll do dumb stuff, like, if I get a labs card on my scav, I'll take the scav kit and the labs card into labs and just see if I can go, you know, take a scav kit and get a raider body out.
Well, it feels like the gods have, you know, pushed that. They're like, well, I got this lab card and I got his PPSH, I guess this is meant to be, you know?
Yeah, and it's like, okay, yeah, you may get lucky. You may catch one of those, you know, one of those elites or whatever down there in, you know, one of the tunnels or whatever, or find somebody who's gone through and clean up their mess.
So,
and then you're just like getting the excess.
Since streaming is a hobby for you, you've put that out in Front Street that like, this is not going to replace my day job. Like, this is just for fun. This is my thing. What would you do if you like rose to that level of like, oh my god, I could quit my job for this? Would that be something you would consider, or did you want to stay where you're at?
It's really hard to think about that, because I don't honestly think of that, of streaming as like a day job or doing it all the way. I have some of the skill set because I have worked for 15 years now, well, maybe longer, at least since 2009. Okay. So 14 years. I have worked as a independent contractor. I have mostly worked for myself, billing other companies and contracted myself
out.
That's
awesome.
So I've had like my own business. I have my business accounts. I have my own tax number, all that stuff. So when I got into doing things for streaming and stuff, it was like, other than figuring out the persona or the name or whatever to go with, I already had all the other skill sets that you need as an independent, you know, contractor. So I could easily translate it if I got the money. If, like, you know, I was making the money that I make in my day job, hell yeah, I could do that. The other thing I look forward to is I have, and I've mentioned it on stream a lot, I have a debilitating disease that eventually will probably leave me as handicapped and unable to work. And would streaming be able to, you know, supplement my income when I do have to go on disability? You know, at some point that would be, you know, a dream to have something coming in a little bit on the side when that eventuality happens. But that eventuality may be 10, 15, 20 years down
that's
the road.
A question
it may
mark.
Not be tomorrow. Yeah. So when does that happen?
So with something like that looming, does that kind of give you kind of a fresh perspective on like life? Are you finding yourself doing things normally wouldn't do? Be like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to eat that. Or I'm going to I don't know if it's this extreme. I'm going to jump out of a plane, or, you know, just like random things you normally wouldn't do.
So the weirdest part about this whole thing was about 2 years before I lost my job and went back to school, I got diagnosed with the heart condition. And it's a fairly serious semi-rare condition. At that time in 2015, they had only a few genetic markers that they could use. I went to Hopkins and stuff, and they took my DNA to add to their testing to make sure that, you know, people that have markers similar to my DNA would be identified as people that might have this disease, you know, because at that point in time, they hadn't even, you know, gotten a full genetic, download of the
right,
whole
the
disease.
The mapping is still so fresh. It's hard to know.
So there's a Tim McGraw song that I listen to all the time, Live Like You Were Dying.
Okay.
And that literally became like my motto, my whole way of being changed at that moment. I found out I had it. It was the day after the 4th of July in 2015. I was working from home because we had to have a new spigot put on the front of the house. So the plumber was there working on the front of the house, and I had left my cell phone inside. We have a split level house, and I was like running up two flights of stairs to go get my phone because I could hear it ringing. And the next thing I know is the plumber is waking me up on the stairs.
It must have been so scary.
And I had literally passed out on the way up the stairs.
You didn't fall down the stairs,
and
right?
Oh, no, I fell face forward into the hallway at the top of the stairs. So luckily, not down the stairs, not backwards. I fell face forward at the very top step. But I came to with her shaking me awake. Right. And it was like, okay, I don't even remember how I got here. This wasn't like, you know, when you're out drinking with your buddies and you pass out somewhere, you at least knew how you got there.
Yeah, there's a vague memory, although hazy. Whereas
I don't know how the hell I wound up here, and I don't know why I'm looking at this lady shaking
me
awake.
Like a Batman villain, you're just out.
And yeah. And so it was like, go into the ER. My blood pressure was like 211 over 140.
Oh my God. And then for reference, 120 over 80 is like the national standard. That's like considered normal.
Yeah. Like if you go over that, they start putting you on medication. Yeah. So I was like 211 over 140. And they were like, oh, okay. You need to go over here. And they started hooking me up to machines. And then they put me on this, on my back on this table. And they do the echocardiogram, which is like it's basically a sonogram of the heart. And the first words of the technician is something you never want to hear. And he's like, oh shit.
No. Oh no. See, technicians usually don't have bedside manner.
Dude, that's not what I want to hear when you're looking at my heart. Like, oh shit. So yeah, they started giving me medication and stuff that summer. And one time I woke up in the back of a ambulance with shock paddles on me. And another time that summer, I literally woke up to the smell of burning chest hair from them paddling me.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So, like, the worst smell on the planet is your own chest hair burning. And so, yeah, I was like, I woke up twice from them jacking me back into life, you know. And it's like, so my perspective definitely has changed at that point. If I want a burger now, it's like, okay, what are you gonna do, kill me? But no, it was more things like, I was super introverted, like live in the basement, typical geek programmer, you know, don't come out for anything but meals and
then hiss at the sun when it does touch you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Things like that. Like prototypical programmer in the basement. And when the thing, like with the opportunity, I was in my 40s when the opportunity to come up and go to Oxford came up. And it was like, do I go? I toyed with the idea for about 30 seconds.
Right.
And it was like, why would you not
exactly
go? Like, you got an invite to go to Oxford for a term. Like, why wouldn't you go? And you get to pick your own topics. Like, what do you want to study? What would you go if you could study anything at Oxford? We're talking like climbing Everest.
Oh, absolutely. That's a bucket list thing for so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like the whole time you're there, I joke about it. It's like the minute you step off the train in Oxford with your suitcases and stuff, you realize you're the dumbest man in the entire town. Or woman, you know, depending on who it is. But you joke about it, and then you realize there's only like, you know, at that point, there's like 30,000 other kids in the entire town that are going to the same university setting that you're going for. And maybe 18 of them at the college I was in were in English. The rest were like in different fields. Right. So I'm like one of 20 people that are actually learning English at this university right now.
See, that's crazy how something that some people would view as debilitating, something that people would view as, you know, like a scary moment, in a way gave you permission to live life on your own terms. Like, it pushed you out of that comfort zone. In a way, it like forced you out of that basement. Like, you know, little Lord of the Rings reference, that was Gandalf putting the thief symbol on your door. You know, next thing you know, you're hanging out with dwarves in a mountain, only now it's Oxford.
Yeah, it's exactly that. There are things where I do still, you know, I still take pause. Do I really want to go to that meeting? Like, COVID was one of the things. Like, I, with my condition, obviously didn't want to get COVID, so it was like
compromised.
So it was like I took extra precautions and stuff. I wore masks, you know. I still wear masks today, mainly if I'm going out in public, like grocery store or Target or something, you know, I wear a mask because I don't know. And if I get something, I don't know how my heart's going to deal with it. But there's other things like, do you want to write for this magazine and maybe see if you'll get published? Hell yeah, I'll give it a shot. You know, at this point, I don't even think twice about some of those things that would have kept me, you know, before the disease, before any of the diagnosis, before any of the, you know, coming back from the edge, any of those things. There's areas that I just, out of precaution, you know, we'll, you know, take a second look at things. But there are things now where, yeah, I'm just going
to
leap off
the fear
this cliff.
Of rejection is minimalized to a much greater scale when you're facing something like
that. Oh, and I have a jar of fucks that has nothing in it. Like, honestly, there are people that will like just say insulting things or something. And it's like, you don't bother me. You're not going to be at my funeral. It's like, do I care?
Like when somebody's negative to you on Twitch, so it's like, all right, well, fuck off. Like, what do I care?
Oh. Yeah. It's like, you know, the usual trolls on the internet. It's like, they don't bother me. Cause it's like, literally I can take 2 seconds to block you. If you come back or find a way around the block, oh, 2 more seconds, you know, I really don't care. Like there are situations where literally I have no fucks to give. And it's, and my wife got me, it's a bar or a jar that some guy took a router and, you know, cut out a bunch of fucks, and it's all of them inside this jar. And she, it literally says it's my jar of fucks. And it's like, I just empty it like every day. It's like that jar starts empty, and it's like occasionally I'll put one in if I care about something, you know. But it's an interesting perspective when you're like, you know, you're playing with house money, and you just approach life with that.
See,
now
it's kind of crazy how people who have been in these scenarios, people who have had near-death experiences, people who are, like, you know, facing looming circumstances like this have such a different perspective on life. Like, I was in the military, and there was a lot of moments that were very near miss. And, like, as scary as that shit was at the time, like, looking at it after the fact, it made me so much a better person, because now I'm not hindered by little things like that. I don't care so much about things that used to be absolutely, like, you know, stopgaps in the past. And it's just crazy looking back on that. So that's actually a very cool perspective, how like something like that is not just like, you know, oh no, poor me, this is a like a death set. No, it gives you like complete clarity in so many different regards. And the fuck jar is a great visual representation, because that's something that you can like physically touch, physically see, and it's just a reminder, be like, yeah, what do I care about that?
Yeah. And it's like, I haven't been in like, you know, life or death combat situation or anything. Like, I haven't faced death, you know, with a bullet coming at me.
I think you faced death closer than me.
Time,
I mean, hell, you had a medical tech. Oh shit. Well, looking at your heart, you were probably closer than I was.
But yeah. And it's like, it's a different perspective, but in a way it's, you know, a shared experience in that, Yeah, I haven't. I would never compare anything in my life to, you know, the horrors of modern combat. I mean, I don't have to worry about 155s coming in over my head or landing on me. You know, I would, at this point in my life, I wouldn't worry because, hey, if a 155 hits me, I'm gone.
But it's one of those things where you can get to the same conclusion through different pathways.
Yeah. But I had also, there are other things that affected me and in my career and in my life that even before the heart disease, I mean, I lived in the DC area during 9/11. So I literally could see the smoke from the Pentagon from my house. So it's like, there are things like that that have happened in my lifetime. My job was at AOL, was to support, CNN.com on 9/11. There were people in my group who basically had to keep that website running.
It's crazy.
All 9/11. And if you think about things like, we didn't have cloud technology. We didn't have this level of technology. This is 22 years ago.
Things have progressed very fast.
The technology wasn't even like a smartphone doesn't exist. You know, cell phones were the Nokias.
Right. Those bricks. I remember those bastards.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in the eighth grade when that all happened. And it's crazy to look back and be like, that really wasn't that long ago. And there's people who were like, you know, 18 rolling around who weren't alive when that happened. And that's crazy to me. It's like, what?
There was a picture that went around the other day, and it's what told me I'm old, is it was a picture of, I'm trying to remember who it was. Anyway, it was a picture of Lenny Kravitz when he was a kid. His mom was an actress, and they were on like a 747 Pan Am or something from the 80s. And they're eating like a chicken dinner in coach. And the dude next to his mom is smoking a cigarette, and there's like the haze of the entire cigarettes on planes and stuff. And then there was like all of this stuff that when this went around at the universities, like Zoomers didn't have any clue. Like, they were like, you could smoke on a plane. Yeah. You could do this. You could eat dinner on a plane.
You could do it anywhere.
And I was like, yeah, believe it or not, you know, before 9/11, you could do, you used to be able to go right up to the gate. Like right up to the plane and walk your people on to the ramp almost, you know, and hug them and stuff. And that's like, you can't even get through
TSA.
That's
what you see a lot in older movies, is walking right up to the gate. And it's kind of sad that, like, because those were always really impactful scenes in movies, or usually really impactful scenes in movies. So it's kind of sad that that's kind of like taken away from like movies in the future. Like, they're not going to be having those kinds of moments.
Oh yeah. It's like, you can tell, like, Die Hard, even just like getting off the plane, the whole sequence of him getting at the airport, you know, and it's like this whole thing is like there's like a big dividing line of pre 9/11 and things that happened with 9/11 that just there's an entire generation I get reminded of that they don't know life before 9/11. They weren't even born.
It's a completely different mindset.
And they're, you know, they're college seniors now. And it's like, oh, okay.
It's fucking nutty. So since you brought up Die Hard, I have to ask, dang newbie, is Die Hard a Christmas movie or is it not a Christmas movie?
Die Hard is a Christmas
Boom.
Movie. There is no compromise.
I fully agree.
It literally ends with a Christmas song being sung as the credits roll.
This is true. Is Gremlins a Christmas movie?
Yes. I saw Gremlins at Christmas when it came out.
See?
Like, it came out, and, like, that Christmas was when I saw it.
You're batting 1,000 right now, dang. Because I know so many people who argue, like, they choose this hill to die on, and I don't understand why. If you're listening to this...
Mowgli is literally... The Mogwai is actually given as a Christmas present.
Exactly.
How can it not be Christmas movie? That's like saying, you know, Rankin Bass didn't make Christmas movies. They made claymation.
Right. So, last question on this topic of Christmas movies. What is your favorite Christmas movie? I know, it's hard. Do you go claymation? Do you go year without a Santa Claus? You go Santa Claus is coming to town with like, I'm Mr. Heat Miser and all that bullshit. Like, it's,
yes,
it's so hard.
It's a tie between the Miser Brothers and Year Without a Santa Claus. So that one is probably number one, tied with Michael Caine's Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh, that one's so good. Like, those are all really good. On my list, I have to have Jingle All the Way, Arnold and Sinbad, because it's such a stupid movie. It's so fun.
That's one of those, like, I wish it was a summer movie, but at Christmas, for some reason, people don't do the whole, you know, suspend all belief and, you know, and go in and just enjoy a Christmas movie. It's not like, you know, there might be 5,000 plot holes in a Mad Max, but you're not watching it for the plot holes. You're watching it for the explosions.
I mean, that movie just feels like
Independence Day
classic.
But it's just, that's like, yeah, it's like the Christmas version of Independence Day. It's just like, or a Michael Bay film. It's like, just ignore the dialogue and just watch the funny, right? You know,
it feels like a Greek tragedy almost, because he's just constantly being demasculated. Like, after that, goes like, wait till the last minute. It's like, you know, like giving the fuck you to Poseidon and never getting to come home. And then he finally like brings it home.
It's like, it's like, for me, it's just like, there are those, but then I go back to a lot of the classics, and it's like George C. Scott's version of Christmas Carol. That's what I saw growing up. But then Michael Caine came along with the Muppets, and it's like, he's one of the best Scrooges ever, and he's literally surrounded by like one other human, and everybody else is, you know, a Muppet. And it's like, how can you put in that kind of a performance when everybody else literally around you is made
and
out of felt?
And the Marley Brothers song went so fucking hard.
Yeah.
You're doomed, Scrooge. You're doomed for all time. Your epitaph is written by your crimes or something. Like, it's fucked up. As a little kid, I'm like watching this. Like, your chains are worn for what you say and do. And at the end of this life, the nightmare waits for you. He's like, holy fuck, this is scary.
Yeah, we had a meme in my family. My dad and I have this sarcastic wit that we, you know, have no problems sitting around in a lawn chair watching something happen and being Statler and Waldorf. When he was around, we would literally, you know, sit there at the park and watch a kid that was about to like learn a lesson and just be that pair of old guys going, yep, he's going to
do
it.
Laugh?
He's going to touch that. Oh, we would do the belly laugh. Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. We used to have a saying in our family. I had this one aunt that I grew up with, and her reaction to pretty much everything was to call you a dumbass to your face, like, you dumbass. And she'd watch you like literally go over and pick up the hot sparkler that got dropped in the water by the wrong end and burn your hand. And then she'd go, you
but
dumbass.
But it was an endearing dumbass though, you know?
Oh yeah. It was like, I mean, she was one of my favorite aunts ever. And it was like, but yeah, my dad and I would sit there and do the whole, you know, that kid's going to go trip and fall down the stairs or whatever, because he's, you know, paying more attention to waving his little wand around in the sky or whatever. And then you watch him fall down, and it's like, called it.
Right. So,
but for us, it was more like watching dumb stuff on TV, and you're like, that guy's going to totally lose. And it's like, yep, did it.
Now, did you have a Christmas story type gift? Like, you know, the Red Ryder BB gun. Did you have a toy like that that was like instrumental to your childhood when you were a certain age? Like, I have to have that. Like, could you relate to that movie at any point?
Oh, I'm trying to think. There was, well, I was on both ends of this. There was the year that He-Man came out and Castle Grayskull playset came out. That was like I had to have Castle Grayskull. Right. I had to have He-Man and you know, all of the Skeletor and all of the bad guys and everything. And it was like, that was like the year that I had to have a toy. And then the year Cabbage Patch Dolls came out, my little sister had wanted one. And that was when my mom lined my brother and I up at a Target on Black Friday at like 3 in the morning. And our only job was to sprint to the toy department that we knew, because that's where she would leave us when she was shopping for everything right. else. So we knew where to go. And she was like, each one of you grab a Cabbage Patch doll. It has to have black hair like your sister. And you have to go get one. And then when I get there, we're going to look at which one's the best and put the other one back on the shelf.
That was the first, like, Tickle Me Elmo. That was the first toy people really lost over. That actually was like the birth of Black Friday as we knew it, because now it's very tame.
Oh, it was, yeah. That was like the first time that you saw grown-ups, like, smashing each other over the head with a shopping
cart.
Taking
toys out of children's
like
hands.
World wrestling style. Yeah, like world wrestling style, because what happened was my brother was 3 years younger than me, and he was like, I think 5 or 6 when this was going on. And this other, he went and grabbed a Cabbage Patch, and the lady went to grab it and literally picked him up off the ground while grabbing the doll that he had.
What? That's crazy.
And so I'm the 8-year-old going over and kicking this lady in the shins so she'll let my brother back down. And I was like, that was like, yeah, for like Jingle All the Way brings back memories about that, because it's literally like the same thing. But picture Sinbad and Arnold being, you know, 8 and 5.
Christmas by Combat.
Yeah, and that, exactly. That's the picture of the '80s when you see like Black Friday, and when they would have televisions for $1 or something, and you just see fights at the local Walmart on your news every night.
That's the coolest part about shopping for animals for the holidays. You go to like PetSmart, you go to your local place, and it's nothing like that. It's real simple.
There's 3 people in the parking lot. There's literally like 3 people at PetSmart on a Sunday the week before Christmas. Like I had to go to Home Depot today, and it was like Home Depot the Sunday a week before Christmas. Terrible place to be.
Oh, God. Yeah, no. I'd be miserable. Especially if you live in a place where it snows, because people are getting those last-minute, like, items, too. Like, oh, fuck, I don't have a shovel. Or, you know, things like that.
Oh, yeah. And growing up in Michigan, it always snows, so it's like, yeah.
So you said you went to Michigan State, so that would make you a Spartan, correct?
Yeah. Briefly, I was.
Now, when you were there, did you have ill contempt and hatred towards the Wolverines, or did you not partake in that?
I actually, my sophomore year when I was there, guarded Sparty on the night before Michigan State.
Because they steal it, right?
Bronze statue. Yeah. No, it's they try to egg it, and it's like playing Secret Service to the president, like. We hold blankets and stuff. You get like broomsticks with blankets taped between them, and you're holding them up like a volleyball net to try and stop the eggs from hitting the Sparty statue.
That's actually hilarious. Now, do you?
It's like,
do you still have like that kind of school? Do you watch Spartan games like football, basketball, anything like that?
So. Michigan State in football used to be almost always was like around Thanksgiving weekend. And they found that like domestic violence went up like 40% that weekend.
Shit.
Because it literally is like, it's like brother and sister versus each other. And in my family, we had all Spartans because I got into MSU. But I grew up, actually, what's funny is before I got accepted to MSU, I grew up a Wolverine fan. I loved Bo Schembechler and the 80s and 90s Wolverines. But I applied for both, and I only got into Spartans. So I was like, I'm a Sparty now. I hate the Wolverines. And in my family, it wasn't that bad. But I knew other families that literally like drew guns on each other on that weekend.
Declaration of war, damn near
And when it's over Thanksgiving and you got the entire family there, and you're 50-50 split, you know, between Michigan and Michigan State, and it's like if there's the Desmond Howard call or whatever, and it's like you totally won by cheating and blah blah blah. It's just like I'm a lot better off now that I'm distanced from there.
Right. You can sleep easy knowing you're not going to have a Glock pulled on you because the Wolverines.
Yeah. It's like nobody's going to pull the shotgun out and load it, you know, in the living room in case the refs make a bad call this year.
Right. You survived the violence of Black Friday, survived the violence of growing up in a house divided.
Yes, definitely. And it's like I have friends who lived in one, you know, in one world in U of M. And it's like for that weekend, we just don't talk. Or if we do talk, it's not sports. It's like, you know, something else. Yeah. Just don't talk about the rivalry.
So, being from somebody who has all the writing background, do you constantly find that newer things like TV shows and movies, do you find them to be predictable, lazy? Because I've heard this from a lot of people who were like, go down this type of academics. They're just very bored with like current popular things. Like, do you find yourself falling into that kind of category?
I do and I don't. Things that I can see that come out of Hollywood, it's kind of a mix for me. It's a mix of, I feel really sorry for the writers because I know that from day one of whatever writing class they've ever taken, they're told not to do cliches. And I know that they go in with a good script, you know, that doesn't have a cliche here or there. And then the executives who actually have the money and pay for the television show or the movie get a hold of it. And I've worked for enough people to know, you know, that the big boss with the money that signs the checks is going to get his or her way.
Right.
And so you just see them write the cliches. I use the Hallmark, you know, movie as the kind of the example of that. I know people that write for Hallmark aren't, you know, they aren't going out and just cutting and pasting the next thing in there, but Hallmark's like, you know, there's all these people in the Midwest and you know, other places who eat this shit up all the time. And so we're just going to do another blonde woman who goes back and finds the burly billionaire, you know, and it's like
animals, it works.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, and he's going to show up totally at the Christmas tree lot, you know, with his kid. And she's got the divorce. She's divorced and single mom with another girl. And they're just going to all fall in love and make the Brady Bunch. And it's like, yeah, I see that all the time. And it literally, I feel bad, you know, for somebody who's stuck in a writing job, having to write those stories. I mean, they're getting a paycheck, so I don't feel too bad for them.
But at the end of the day,
it's like their
work is being altered, but there's no like asterisk during the credits. Be like, this person wrote it, asterisk, but it was changed by this guy. So it looks like it's their work, you know?
Yeah. Like the worst thing in the world for me is if I go in and I see on a movie poster from the writers of, you know, National Lampoon's Vacation or something. And it's like, okay, you guys had a hit.
Right.
And then I go in and the movie is horrible. And it's like, I know y'all didn't write this right after the last, you know, after you finished the script on your famous movie or whatever, you didn't go and start writing this piece of trash. And it's like, if that's your selling point on the movie poster, I'm usually suspect. Because
right.
It's like, we're selling this based on, or the other thing that gets me a lot is based on the characters from, you know, based on the story from, you know, Sherlock Holmes or whatever. It's like the Robert Downey Jr. character of Sherlock Holmes is similar to the Arthur Conan Doyle one, but that's where the similarities end. The stories are all made up. They're entertaining stories. It's a great buddy cop movie, you know, with he and Watson. But it's like, yeah, beyond that, it gets to me when you take and say this is based on a story. And then I having read that story, see no resemblance to it. That's the other part that will get me to comment on something faster than not. And yeah, I will look at things rather critically, which is why I tend to look now internationally for new stuff to watch, mainly because with streaming, I can watch, you know, stuff from around the world, but also it's not been dumbed down. It's not been Americanized. It's not been given the McDonald's treatment.
Right. McDonald's treatment. I like that. It wasn't deep fried and smothered. Yeah, it's mayonnaise.
It's like I've been abroad, so I know, you know, and I was abroad like at the worst time in the world. I was abroad during the middle of the Trump presidency. So I got to see how our president was being portrayed as, like, basically in the UK, they had this, it looked like a Muppet that had, you know, a dead ferret on its head. And just all they did to portray him in, like, editorial cartoons and stuff was basically as a shouting dead ferret on his head. And you could tell they were obviously, you know, making social commentary about the president. But it was like, at the same time, it was like the big dumb American is a stereotype for a reason. And I was like, I'm trying not to be that stereotype when I'm over there. And it's just like, but my education in the States, the public school education here, just didn't prepare me for things like, you know, there are other cultures out there. The whole thing about America being the best country, it's like, well, I lived in the UK for 4.5 months. I didn't feel like I was in a, you know, second-rate country.
Right. That perception gets a little shattered when you get to actually go out and experience other places. Like, it's real easy to live in an echo chamber and just hear the same thing yelled back to you. But when you actually, like, go out there and you experience those other places, it kind of, like, you know, you kind of reveal that curtain a little bit and you see the man behind the curtain.
Oh, yeah. So Mark Twain was right. I mean, the best education for a young man is to travel.
Right. No, I would agree with that.
Get away from, even 50 miles away from your hometown. There are people that are different from you. And there are a lot of people who've never even been 50 miles from their house.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's
to me, that's crazy. Because it's like, I try to explain to people from Europe when I meet them and talk to them on stream or something, and they're like, how can, you know, they read something in the paper and it's like, how can, you know, this be true about the American education system? And it's like, well, think about it. You guys have, you know, two provinces in your entire country. What if you had 50 different groups of people who all do things differently?
That's a very good point.
Because that's where we start. That's where we start as a country. We have 50 different cultures. Hawaii is totally different from Maine.
You couldn't get more different.
It's like, but we all, every one of those people in Hawaii and Maine is tethered to this idea that we're all American. And it's like, so at the end of the day, it's kind of like having 49 brothers and sisters. And if you've ever had one of those things where somebody picks on your little brother or sister, and then you go beat the crap out of them. I said, but imagine 49 other people show up to beat the crap out of you. And I said, that's kind of where America starts, is like you got 50 different groups of people, cultures or whatever. Then we start talking about race and whatever else in this country. And it's like you start with 50 different people. We're multi-personality with 50 different personalities.
And then you add on to the thing, like, you brought up with the Wolverine-Spartan thing, like, no issues on drawing on each other over small things.
We're not even talking socioeconomic, racial, none of that. We're talking just 50 different states. Right. Alabama is different from Montana, you know, or North Dakota or Minnesota. It's like, they're totally different. And yet we all get together and talk, you know, in one way or in one voice. And if heaven help you, if like the Japanese found out in World War II, if you attack one of us, you attack the entire country.
Exactly.
And it's like having 49 brothers that show up and have your back.
This is very true. That's an interesting way to look at it, which I'm sure a lot of people don't take the time, especially like when you're in other states. Like I was in Texas, like, I hate California. I'm like, why do you hate California? It's like, they're all this, this, and that. I mean, like, have you met anyone from California? No. It's like, so what, you're getting this from TV?
No. Yeah. Yeah, my radio or my TV told me that. And it's like, I think the worst thing we did in this country, and I could say this having grown up before the era of 24-hour news, is, you know, any sentiment that has entered the society where the guy, like, to your point, the guy in Texas who thinks California is his, is, you know, the enemy. It's like, no, California is going to be there if Texas got a bomb.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, 9/11. 9/11, everybody was there for New York and D.C. Everybody was there.
Regardless of politics, like, regardless of anything like that, yep. Which people forget.
Don't even bring politics exactly. into it. Just every one of those people, like I said, Maine and Hawaii are as different as you could be in terms of people and cultures and society and stuff. And it's like, but I guarantee if somebody, you know, sets off a bomb in the middle of Honolulu, everybody's going to be like, let's go get whoever was responsible.
Exactly.
And like 9/11 was a perfect example of that. Like something happened. We all got together. There was no, yeah, but you know, whether you liked Bush or not, it was all like, no, we're going to go get whoever did
it. You know, that was the time
things were
the least toxic when it came to like the news. Cause you know, news now is very us versus them, depending on what like news platform you watch, whether it be CNN, Fox, whatever. Yeah. I remember that time.
Yeah.
Nobody cared about that kind of shit. Everyone was just nice to each other.
Nah. And news was something that a company like NBC or, you know, one of the big networks, they lost money on it. It wasn't there to sell advertising. And that's the other thing is the whole like Google News, the whole Google algorithm approach to news. Now it's like the headline has to be the most clickbaity, whatever type of thing. And it's like, just let's get away from that. But that was like going overseas was like, yeah, going overseas was like an exposure to how much of that and seeing things that are created, you know, in a different culture, a different way of approaching things. And like I said, it wasn't dumbed down. None of the stuff I watched from there has like the whole McDonald's car chase, you know, element to it, or you know, 52,000, that guy didn't reload and he fired 200 rounds, you know, that's an American thing. Like they actually count their bullets and the guy only shoots five,
right,
you know,
things like that, like small details, which is kind of funny. So when you were over there, when you were overseas, what was your favorite meal, mm-hmm. and what was the worst thing you ate?
So I was in a really weird time over there in the UK. They had just fallen in love with American food. Like, literally. I was in London the weekend. They got their first Taco Bell. And it was literally like we were talking about Black Friday in the 80s. They had fights. They had people, like, fighting over tacos. And I'm like, I wouldn't eat those tacos if I was drunk.
Stop.
In America.
You give you diarrhea. Stop.
I was like, you guys, your sewer system is like 2,000 years old. How are you going to deal with Taco
Bell?
It's not
ready for the Baja Blast.
No. And I was just like, I was amazed by it. But I have to say, the best meal there is a Thai. I had every morning that I would go to the library for studying, I would stop off at the pub on the way in. There was a pub called the Wig and Pen on George Street, which was near where I lived. And they, for £5, would give you a full English breakfast and a Diet Coke. So we're talking two fried eggs, two tomatoes, a bunch of mushrooms, bacon, sausage, blood sausage, beans, toast, the whole works. And it was like £5. So about $7.50 in dollars.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and it's like, I would eat that, and I would not be hungry until I left the library at like 7 or 8 that night. I'd go there at 10. And I would be full till 7 or 8 at night. And the other thing I would say is I was there during Easter, and McDonald's in the UK takes Cadbury eggs and puts them in McFlurries.
What? That's genius.
Yes. And it is amazing.
Oh, I thought you were going to say
amazing. I had one and I was like, it was like instant diabetic coma, but it was so awesome and worth it. And it's like, I was there like when they would roll out fresh Cadburys. And the thing about the UK is they don't use any artificial sweeteners. So no Splendas, none of that stuff. They use just pure sugar based on their health, their United healthcare that they have. And so when I was there, like the Snickers taste like they did in the 80s because they're just sugar.
Oh, that's...
They're not high fructose corn syrup, sugar, and glucose.
That sounds lovely.
And so everything tasted like when I was a kid, and the Cadbury eggs are no exception. They've changed them in America to use like Hershey chocolate, and these still have the Cadbury chocolate. And because they're in the UK, that's where Cadbury's is. So it was like having Cadbury eggs that were fresh off the factory floor and hadn't been Americanized, so they didn't have like three kinds of sugar as the first three ingredients. It was amazing because everything tastes like it. But I would say the worst experience was because of the same health code, you cannot get a medium burger in the UK without signing a consent form.
Really?
So you go to, they're having an American explosion of food while I'm there, and all these burger joints are opening up and stuff, and they have, you know, pubs that became burger joints basically overnight. And you go in and you're like, I'd like a medium, you know, because no one ever should order a higher than medium burger.
Right, medium rare.
In my
like
mind.
Superb.
Medium rare, medium. If you go medium well, I'm going to look at you weird and say, okay.
Be a little judgmental.
But anything gray shouldn't be coming off that line. And they cook them gray, like well done, all of the burgers. So I'm like at a Five Guys in Oxford looking at a gray burger, and I'm just like, you killed it. You literally killed it. It's dead. I'm going to go take this to a gravesite and bury it.
I'm going to mourn the passing of flavor. Why would you do this?
It's like, how could you take a Five Guys burger and cook it well done? And they did. And I was just like, no.
That's so sad.
But that was the worst food experience, was basically getting everything that should be a medium or, you know, rare or whatever cooked to grayness.
So, speaking of Gray and Castle Grayskull, moving back, have you watched the Kevin Smith Netflix He-Man animated series?
I have not, and that's a shame because for years I like my entire wardrobe when I worked at AOL was basically the Clerks. Kevin Smith Clerks outfit.
Nice.
I mean, that's literally what I showed up like every day in, was like shorts, a t-shirt, or a hockey jersey and a ball cap. And like, that was literally like for 5 years of my life was literally my uniform for work. And so I adore all things Kevin Smith. I think he's been a great influence on Hollywood and stuff, but I have not seen his new stuff.
Oh, I get that completely. Like, he's made a lot of new stuff. I haven't had a chance to watch a lot of it. Like, I was big on him back when I was younger. You know, Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Jane, Silent Bob Strike Back. You name it. I loved all that stuff. But the newer stuff, I just haven't had time to get into it. But I have watched a little bit of the Netflix cartoon. I didn't have a background in He-Man, so I didn't have a dog in the fight. I know a lot of people were angry because, you know, people are angry about everything. So I was just curious what your take was on it. But maybe in a few months when you watch it, we'll reach back and we'll get your potentially angry take.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to it. My biggest thing right now is I refuse to, like, buy 10 streaming platforms. I have cable, right. You know. Y'all made streaming platforms to get away from cable, and now it's like I might as well have cable again because you got 10 streaming platforms. You got to pay the same fee every month.
Killed Blockbuster.
And now the bill
is
the same. Yeah, we killed Blockbuster and Friday night new releases at Blockbuster. Like, that was an entire vibe. Like, going to the Blockbuster on a Friday, and you didn't know what you were going to see. I mean, would the movie you wanted to see even be in stock? Exactly.
That was always, like, the gamble. You're like, well, fuck, we're here. What are we going to get?
Well, shit, they don't have Terminator. I guess I'm going to have to get, I don't know, what the hell's that movie about?
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, what's this shit?
You get exposed to, like, entire genres you didn't even know existed as other films, and then you're like, holy shit, that was actually good. And it's all because, you know, Terminator was out.
I'll be back. You didn't even have to watch Terminator. That movie was so culturally relevant. Everyone knows I'll be back.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you never saw the film, you know.
Yeah.
So, we're getting close to our time constraint. So, one of my last questions for you is, was there a particular streamer that got you interested into streaming? And if so, who was it?
There's a mix of about three or four that I know there were two that I was primarily watching when I was first exposed to Twitch, and that was Sequisha and Filthy Robot for various different reasons. Sequisha just for the whole Geshtin, the comedy, the whole, you know, his whole Bone Zone and all that stuff was just, I needed laughs. Yeah, I needed laughs at a time when, you know, my brain was literally melting under the stress of the classes over there. So it was like, just being able to laugh with him for 30 minutes, even about the dumbest stuff, like the Bone Zone or whatever. And it's like, okay, Filthy Robot was more because of the genre. He was playing a lot of strategy games, Battle Brothers and stuff like that. He was top of the heap in that for a long time. And so I was just like doing stuff there. The two, when I got back to the States, that were big influences, I would have to say number one was Sigma, the whole streamer class community stuff that she set up, how to get into it was like huge in like me understanding how to get OBS set up and Chatty and all the other tools that came through.
Which is a mountain.
And just talking to other guys.
Like, that stuff's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was like a bunch of guys like me who were talking to empty rooms, like sharing ideas at the same time. And that Discord is still like one of the top Discords I have on my list. And I would say the second one after that was Queen, because Queen FPS, she was doing, you know, what I wanted to do. I originally thought I was going to be a Tarkov streamer. I was like going to go play more Tarkov and I'd be the next, you know, Pestily or whatever that everybody wants to be in Tarkov. And I was like, you know, I was totally ignoring the physical limitations, but the way that she interacted with her chat and the way that, you know, it was literally like I could watch while I was working from home during COVID or whatever, I could watch her, you know, for 3 hours and wouldn't even think about, you know, the project I just had to write being stressful or whatever, because I was laughing my ass off. And stuff like that, like Sequisha and her for the comedy, for the technical bits, like the game strategy and stuff, that was Filthy. And then Sigma for the how-to. Like, literally, I wouldn't have my OBS setup that I have now without going through streamer class and the stuff that Sigma set up to teach people.
Nice. So if you could work, and when I say work, I mean a charity event, a co-stream, something like that, or maybe even playing Arena. If you could have any kind of working relationship with any streamer out there that you don't already currently have, who would it be?
Oh, that's a good question, and one I probably haven't thought about. I would say, see, I get along with a lot of people in the community that I'm in. Like, having left, I haven't left Tarkov as a viewer. I did leave it as a streamer. I haven't streamed it for like over a year now. So, I mean, in RimWorld, I have a pretty good, at least, you know, the other creators I've worked with in that genre that we all have kind of like a raid, counter raid type of thing going on. And I've met lots of people through that and other strategy games that like outside of the Tarkov thing. But I would say, I don't know, like in Tarkov, I'm like, I make my rounds and people know me, but I'm not like a streamer in that community. I'm just like a VIP or a, you know, a watcher who's constant or whatever. Yeah, viewer. So I get around in the community that way and people notice me that way. But I would say more for like streaming, I'd want to be, you know, I'd want to be in the group that, you know, would have like an invite from Velian or somebody like that, you know, when I wanted to play. It's been a wipe or two since I've played Tarkov full time, but just being in that club, you know, when they have like a non-competitive, just four of us or five of us are going to go jam on customs for 3 hours, like to be in that circle. So I would say just getting into like that. And then I know I say that knowing that I have a performance or imposter syndrome. You know, being disabled, I know that I'm never going to be like the best guy in the squad. And it always makes it hard for me to like play with others. Well, no, just playing with others. I don't want to be the guy carried the whole night. And it's like, you want to be the guy when the whole group dies, you get everybody's kits out. And I'm like, I'm never going to be that guy unless I find a hole and nobody sees me. You know, it's like, I know with my play style and my skills, it's like, I'm not going to be the Gingy or whatever that carries the day. I'm going to be the guy who gets dead first, you know, in most of the situations, and they're going to be carrying me. So that's a hard question for me to answer, because short of a game like RimWorld that I can pause when, you know, my hands aren't working as well, or, you know, I can take a second away from it and just come up with how I'm actually going to defend against this attack, you know? So it's like in FPS games, I just would say it would be anybody who would put me at ease for my imposter and my desire not to be carried. So any big name like that would put up with me for 2 hours or whatever, being the first one to die in the group all night.
Absolutely. No, that totally makes sense. Like, I get that feeling, because usually when I'm playing with my friends, I'm the same way. Only I'm just the guy who, like, keeps them, like, you know, I just don't shut up. I'm just telling jokes the whole time. Like, shut up, I need comms. I need comms. I'm like, I'm sorry. I told you I was going to meme today.
Yeah, the one thing I had was I used to play competitive Arma. I mean, back before I got sick and before I got, you know, into school and stopped playing and stuff. I was, you know, Arma 2 DayZ, I terrorized servers. I was like the guy when I signed in on our clan server that was like, people were like, which team are you playing on? So I picked the right team. And it was like, I went from that to getting sick and losing, you know, the abilities. And as things go, you know, as if you have a disease that progresses, you have things that you can't do. And it's like, I don't have, you know, 15 years ago when I was doing DayZ 10, 15 years ago, you know, I don't have the reflexes that I had then and stuff. So it's kind of like it adds to that imposter syndrome. And it's like, I'm not that guy anymore. I'd love to be, you know, remember that guy. But now it's more like if I could get included in the big boy games, you know, could play with the, you know, Pestilies or the Sequoias or whatever.
Total. No, that completely makes sense. So, last question for you, dang newbie. Mm-hmm. If you could give somebody any piece of advice for somebody who's just getting started in this kind of field, who's nervous, scared, or just getting started in college, or just getting started in anything in general, who's got fear, scared of, like, you know, failure, things like that, what would be your best piece of advice to give?
It's okay to jump off cliffs.
That's well said.
That's my biggest piece of advice is you're going to, like, in school, I, you know, my plan going back to school was to get a bachelor's degree so I could get a job. I was in the middle of a fishing trip with my dad and got invited to Oxford. That's detour number one. I had no plans whatsoever to get a master's degree. I got a master's degree in writing, in English lit. So it's like all of those things were totally unplanned. And before my illness and you know, waking up on a gurney or whatever, and it's like some of those things I never would have done. And now I look back and it's like, yeah, I have kind of a no fucks given or a devil may care attitude about a few things now, but it's more, you know, I realize now my attitude allows me to do those things because I really don't care about, you know, if somebody's going to laugh at me, fuck them. I don't care. I don't even, you know, everybody shits, everybody puts their pants on. It's like, you're no different from me. It's like, I realized that what held me back a lot in my youth and stuff, and I didn't do some of the things I could have done. You know, I didn't date the girl that was way out of my league, and I probably could have, you know, because it's like that thing, that story about thinking back, you know, that lady was actually flirting with me. You know, 10 years later, you realize, oh, shit, I was dumb. It's stuff like that, that going into academics especially, you don't have to stick with your first choice in a major, and you can jump off a cliff. You want to try creative writing? Go try it. I was a freaking project manager for a computer software company. And I started writing stories and poetry that other people liked enough to publish. I never would have thought that was something I'd do. Never. I was like, oh, I can write an email and people listen to me once in a while. But it was never like, oh, somebody actually, you know, wrote me, or like, I posted a poem on Facebook and got 1,000 likes, and it got sent to like 1,000 people I never even met before. And it's just stuff like that. Like, your own brain sometimes holds you back, but I would say jump off the cliff.
You never know where your work's going to take
you. You never know.
Who knows? Maybe somebody's got that Facebook poem like posted, and that's like their inspirational thing. Maybe that's their fuck it jar with the little fucks, you know?
Yeah, it's like, to me, it's more, you've got more things that hold you back in your own mind. And worrying about, like, what other people think, or what your dad wants you to be, or what, you know, growing up, you know, I wanted to be a cop growing up. I wound up in IT. I thought I was going to go to Air Force Academy when I was 18. Thought I was going to go there, and then they found a heart murmur. And it's like, well, you're not going there. So you have to make choices based on your situation, but sometimes the scary choice of jumping off the cliff is the right one, and it leads to all kinds of things.
That's very well said. That's a heavy topic, and a lot of people probably have not thought about it like that. But, yeah, you know, it's always better to do that than to play the what if game, because the what if game fucking sucks.
Oh, the what if game is like one of the worst games. And it's even worse when, you know, like if you're in a situation like mine where, you know, you have, you know, less time probably left than most people have. And it's like, what if I had done that? Or what if I had asked, you know, that person out? Or what if I had, you know, done this in high school instead of that? And it's just like, that game sucks. That's like, there are a million different dimensions that might be the same as us or whatever, but slightly different for one choice. And it's like, you're in this dimension. You got to make choices based on where you are now, not where you might have been 50 different choices ago.
You can't beat yourself up for something that Bizarro Land Mike did, you know?
No.
There's no point. The important thing is...
No, and it's like...
I'm almost on the... My kid's yelling at me. So, yeah, the what if game is worse than the day before that game.
Yeah.
There's just no winning on that one. So, coming to the conclusion here, last thing. Now is your time, gang, to say whatever it is you would like to say. Whether it is to thank mods, thank your community, talk about something that's coming up with your stream. Now is your time. The floor is yours.
Well, I'm just, like I said, I'm a weekend streamer, so I do Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern to whenever. We just have a very casual community, and I'd like to thank every one of them that shows up, because I spent a long time talking to an empty room and when I was first starting out in this, and now it's like I have regulars that show up, so that's awesome. If you're thinking about getting into this, make sure you're getting into it for the right reasons, and the first one of those reasons should be fun. Don't forget the fun, because it's going to suck doing this as a job if you're not enjoying it. People think they'd enjoy playing video games all day, but I'm here to tell you, if you did that and you're not having fun, then it comes through to your audience, and it comes through to your soul, and you just won't want to do it anymore. Right.
It can become a job. And then you don't want gaming to become your thing that used to be a stress reliever to be something that's a source of stress and something you later hate down the road because you did it for an occupation, you know?
Yeah. And the worst thing of it is you have a shitty boss and it's yourself.
You have a shitty boss and his name happens. Is Nikita. Fuck you, Tarkov.
Yeah. and if you continue to do it, if you continue to sign up for that abuse, you have no one else to blame but yourself, and you are your own boss as a streamer. Yeah, so it's like you have a shitty boss and it's you, you know, in that situation. So it's like sometimes it's easy. It's easier to step away.
Absolutely. So that was a fun conversation today for episode 107. I would like to take this time to thank you, Dang, for coming on. Because it's always asking somebody to jump off a cliff, so to speak, to have an hour and a half conversation with a complete stranger. So I really appreciate everybody who takes that dive.
I appreciate it. It was fun. And thank you for reaching out to me.
No worries. We're going to have all of Dang's links, Dang Newbie's links, in the description of the episode. CastleCom shirts just dropped, so we're going to put the link there, too. Other than that, what else is there to say other than I'm the ape that nobody? And why don't you go outside and touch and or smoke some grass? And we'll see you next time on the comms.